the hell they've been through. We all know them as the Joneses. So don't compare yourself to anyone else. Keep your eyes in your own backyard. What's theirs is theirs and yours is only for you. Whatever the hand, you've got to play your cards. Cause you were born to be like the greatest of men.
Stay tuned for Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, ooh, turns my whole world. Of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I tried.
Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we are streaming live at KUCI.org. Today is Wednesday, May 23rd, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Leland De La Durante. Before I introduce Leland, though, I want to thank all of you who donated to the KUCI fundraiser in the last couple of weeks. In the name of Writers on Writing, you have helped to keep the lights on and to keep our show on the air and to keep KUCI on the air. So I thank all of you so much for doing that. Leland de la Durante is a critic, translator, and professor of comparative literature at the Claremont Colleges. His journalism and criticism have appeared in the New York Times, the London Review of Books, Book Forum, Art Forum, and The Believer. In the words of literary critic James Wood, "Hannah versus the Tree is unlike anything I have ever read, thriller, myth, dream, and poem combined." And Amy Hempel writes, "Betrayal and vengeance have rarely been so elegantly rendered as in this searing novel." Leland is with us this morning to talk about Hannah versus the Tree and the art, craft, and business of writing. Hi, Leland.
Good morning. Hi.
So great to have you on. I first saw you actually at the LA Times Festival of Books, and it was, I think, the best panel that I saw that weekend, and you and the way you talked about Hannah versus the Tree was entrancing, really. And I wonder if we could begin with you introducing the book and talking about how it came about.
Sure, I'd be happy to. As far as I can tell, it came about quickly, but it might also have come about really slowly. Which is to say, I'm 46 and have been, in one way or another, experimenting with fiction for most of my life, or since I learned to write, and have often dreamt of writing a novel, have often begun writing a novel. But the novel itself was written relatively quickly, a few years ago, in Rome. I was on sabbatical, and I was meant to be translating Italian philosophy. And I'd just become a full professor and felt a new freedom as regards my own writing and production. And I found myself writing Hannah. At first, I thought I was maybe just sketching or experimenting, but relatively early on in that year, I began to see the shape of the story and then was able to work through to its completion.
I think that's really interesting that you wrote it in Rome and that you rarely spoke English that year. You were mostly involved in Italian, but you wrote in English. And I'm curious how that might have affected the writing. Do you think it would have come out differently had you not gone to Rome? You were on sabbatical in, I don't know, Minnesota, pick a state, anywhere.
Yeah, I'm unqualified to say. It could be just the story that I had inside of me, and that it would have come out wherever you would have plopped me. But I definitely felt strongly, I felt inspired by Rome in a few regards. One is the beauty and antiquity of the place. You see so much deep history. There's certain very prominent figures from Roman history which play small parts in the book, like Hannibal. Of Carthage. There is a factor, I think, that would have been different if it had been Minnesota or Rome, but might not have been different if it were Paris and Rome, which is just living in another language, living in a foreign language, which is something I've done a number of times in my life. I lived in Paris for years. I lived in Berlin for many years, and I do think there's some effect on the writing language if it's not in everyday use. And I think that effect is desire for the mother tongue, desire for the native language. When I sat down to write English, I was really excited to and energized to, and it was going to be the hours in my day in which I was living and the only language that's really mine. So I think some of the influence is the estrangement effect of being outside of one's language. And I don't know that it would have mattered so very much if I was in around one language or another. But I do think the influence of Rome, historically conducive for artistic creation, I do think it had some very positive effect. And last, I suppose, the point would be is it's very far from Southern California, very far from my job, very far from my everyday surroundings. And so I do think it helped me to do something new in a foreign place, or a relatively new place for me.
You have said that you had worked on a novel before this one that you ended up just throwing out. I am so curious about that. I think a lot of writers, the first novel they just cling to, because of all the time put into it, and you know, it's your first. And I think being able to let go of a first novel, or maybe even a second, to write the third, to write the one that is the one that, I don't know, you get it right. Talk about doing that, and how you did that. Was that difficult? And you know, what did you come to with that first novel?
Well, I see it clearly, and I see its flaw. I see it had a really fatal flaw in it. In a way, that was a flaw in the plot or the story, but it was really a flaw in the conception and the attitude. I thought that I was relatively good at describing or evoking certain atmospheres or emotional states, but I thought that I didn't know how to write a novel like people were expecting to read, and so I tried to tie myself as closely as possible to a very narrative genre of the novel. And so I was writing a very strange detective novel called Analyst Architect Accident, and it got quite far along in the life of the book, which is to say, my agent got an offer for it, even though the book was unfinished. And at that point, only I knew that I couldn't finish it, or that any conclusion would be unsatisfactory. Something of that has to do with the calculatory possibilities of detective novels. I think we definitely expect a lot of coherence in the resolution of a detective novel. And I structurally wasn't really in a position to give what I thought would be a fascinating end to the story. But the real problem was that I thought that I could only write a novel if I wrote what I thought people wanted. That they wanted a plot, like a detective plot, that moves along at a certain set pace, and that I would be giving publishers a recognizable genre, even if a relatively strange production in it. And so I tried everything I could think of and spent lots of time reorganizing and reconceiving of the text, and I liked the writing more and more, but I didn't like the whole. And when the offer came, then that was a sort of moment of truth, and I had to be honest with myself that I wouldn't be satisfied with anything that I'd be able to finish, and I didn't think I could make it a really good, complete book. And so that was definitely hard to do. It was hard for me at the time to conceive of how much time and effort I'd put into it, which at that moment seemed like pure waste. In hindsight, it doesn't seem like waste at all. It just seems like training and learning a pretty basic but fundamental lesson, which is that I had to write my own book. I shouldn't just write along the model of things that were successful. And so when I wasn't going to make that same mistake again with Hannah. I was just writing the story in the form that it came to me, or the form that I saw. And so now, with this viewpoint, that first step along the way, that first novel, I'm really happy it didn't get published. I would cringe and wince at it if it were out there. I'm really happy that it's safe in a drawer somewhere where it's not going to disappoint anyone.
That's so unusual, but really, putting a book aside. You know, it's when you've been given an offer, when you've been, you know, you have this book deal looming, and you say, oh, you know, never mind.
Yeah, I definitely felt a twinge of guilt for the publisher, for my agent. I should have been able to realize before they began that process that I wasn't going to be able to finish it. I wasn't going to be able to finish it the way they wanted it finished. But I wasn't, and all parties were very kind about it. Yeah, it definitely is very, very hard in any domain to put aside a lot of work and a lot of time and life and passion, whether that I've written some academic studies, and I have a few academic projects that were of that sort that were relatively far along, and I just realized I had to abandon them because they really weren't coming together. And that is a kind of pleasing pain. It's definitely painful on one hand, but it is, once a little time passes, you see that it's not a race, and you see that some things can't be fixed. And so it was definitely, it was scary for me at the time, because I thought, because I can't finish this book, because I can't finish this novel, I'll never finish a novel. And basically, in the months and even years immediately after I wrote that first novel, I was no longer considering myself as someone who was going to write a novel. I thought I'd tried, and whatever else I wrote would be different. And so in a way, Hannah came to me as a surprise. And maybe I couldn't have so easily simply set out to do it. Maybe I needed to be doing something else from which I was playing hooky to a certain extent to write it. I'm not sure.
And yet, there are aspects of the thriller in Hannah versus the Tree. Do you feel like, you know, you said nothing's ever wasted. Do you feel that you brought that maybe aspect of writing that first book into Hannah?
Quite possibly. There's the general experience of, Amy Hempel was talking about it on your show recently, not wanting to give the reader a chance to stop, not wanting to give the reader an excuse to quit reading, wanting to hold your reader, which is the most natural writerly instinct. With a thriller, you're holding it, or certain kinds of detective stories or thrillers, you're holding it very powerfully through plot, through how is this all going to come together into an intelligible design, who did it. But for me here, that sunk more deeply into the prose of the book itself. I wanted to write a relatively trim, relatively short book that held the reader and ideally didn't let them go. And I think writing that other book, in which I was, of course, trying to create that, create a text like that, create a relationship with the reader like that, of dreaming of the reader hanging on your every word, that was definitely part of the apprenticeship process. But I was doing it by a very different means, with a very different tone. My book's in the second person and is written in a quite passionate, direct tone, whereas that book was written in a relatively distanced third person, and it was very hard for me to create urgency from the third person with any other means but plot turns and red herrings and cliffhangers.
I did want to ask you about the size of the book. It's a small book. I don't know how many manuscript pages it was that you turned in, but talk about size. And you said you wanted to write a small book, or you envisioned a small book?
I did feel that was, right for me and right for the times. I don't think it's, it seems to me outlandish to expect readers who don't know me to read some thousand book doorstopper from me. I thought that I couldn't make too great a claim on the reader's time and attention, and so I wanted something that could be more easily consumed, and that was a factor in size. But I really just wanted something that was balanced and harmonious for me, and that the book definitely turned out to be shorter than I thought it would be. The last phase of its composition was more a phase of deletion and destruction and winnowing it down to something quite short. And so I thought about it as me as an unknown author or an unknown fiction author, but I also thought about it a bit. The time seemed to me quite fast, and it's hard for books, and especially hard for long books, to get read. And so both ideas were on my mind when I was writing it. I did. I was a little concerned about its brevity when I finished it, and that concern proved founded, which is to say, when my agent began to shop the book around, a few publishers were interested in it, but they needed it longer. Just for definitional purposes. For them, it was going to be in the category of a novella, even though it felt to a few of them like a novel, and they wanted me to expand it. One publisher wanted me to expand it just anywhere. They just needed it somehow to be longer. Another publisher wanted me to expand a certain phase of it. And I really couldn't do either because it felt really complete to me as it was. And so I got to see two sides of the market. One, a certain side of the market wants the units to be of similar size, length. People get a novel to have about such and such time reading. And so I understood that part of the market. But McSweeney's, who were really beautiful, the beautiful publishing house was really lovely to work with, they didn't have that idea at all, and they really weren't concerned with the market in that same way. They were much more concerned with aesthetic questions, and so happily that wasn't a part of the dialogue once the book was purchased.
Yeah, McSweeney's puts out some wonderful books, and they, you know, so many of them look different, you know, different sizes, different types of covers. I love sort of the creativity there. It's quite nice.
Me too. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I am too. I am too. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Leland de la Durante. His book is Hannah Versus the Tree. Do you have a book there? Can you read a little bit for us?
Okay. Yeah, happily.
Great.
I assume that you know little of the facts of my family in any but the most distorted manner, thanks to the accounts of your nephews who are, as you may know, psychopaths. The answer to your lawyer's first question is that Hannah was six. I was six. She was walking across wood chips with your daughter-in-law. You may say what you like about my mother, and I have gathered that you do, but not that she lacked initiative. My mother approached your daughter-in-law, whom I had assumed to be a duchess or a sorceress or an astrophysicist or in some other way deeply inaccessible, coming from so far away as they did, and it was arranged. After a few hours of erranding to one place and another, all boring, the dogs impatient, we at last came to a stop in front of a glass house. As we walked towards it, I could see into it. It's green. It's tree. Hannah. It smelled nice inside your son's home. I had never been in a house with a tree growing through it before. We descended a level and sat down next to a fireplace, all warm wood in the colors of children, red, orange, yellow, and were silent. I had a hat, and it was pulled low, and no, I did not wish to take it off. Looking directly at Hannah at that range seemed as safe as staring at the sun and the heat and light and source of all life. I recall everything in the room, provided it was within a few feet of the ground. I remember a sculpture of Sedna, its soapstone smooth and fluid, and how I moved over it in my mind again and again, looking for calm. When my silence was noted, I asked what it was, this woman becoming something else, or so many other things. Hannah began to answer that she was a princess in the northernmost north when your daughter-in-law said in a loud voice that it was an Inuit mermaid, giving Hannah a nudge, for it was not, as Hannah later told me, a story for guests or children. The mothers left and Hannah approached. I saw bare, honey-colored feet, each big toe with a daub of nail polish, one red, one orange. With the tips of her fingers, Hannah slowly lifted the brim of my hat until, at last, I saw. Her eyes were blue, like the sea, and flecked with bits of gold, like sunken treasure. The way she spoke was festive, as was the whole cadence of her playful little person. She was to show me the house. I followed her down a glass corridor, the green of Michigan on all sides, as she told me the story of Sedna. Many of the objects she presented were strange. Those that looked like the water, such as Sedna, were Inuit, Anna said. Seal, narwhal, killer whale, kayak, shaman. They are my mother's things, she said. But the majority of things in the house were another kind of foreign, from another world, from the south, from Hannah's youth, from Ecuador. We went there to stop my father's family from digging a hole in the Amazon, she said. And so it was that I first heard of what you do, or did. As Hannah told me the dangers of the jungle, I remember the sky grew bluer until it couldn't anymore, and then turned darker and the insects streamed from the forest behind the house, enlivening the air, bringing birds and bats. What do you think they think of one another, Hannah asked. Do the birds think the bats are good flyers but change their minds all the time? That they have great technical skill but no real program? Or do they know that the bats are screaming their way through the dark? And the bats, Hannah asked, what do they think? Maybe they don't care, she said with a little sigh. Then she turned to me, gold glimmering in depths, and dared me to soap opera kiss her.
Thank you so much. That was Leland de la Durante reading from Hannah Versus the Tree, published by McSweeney's. so curious about your narrator, a secondary character in the second person. We talk about that. Talk about coming to that point of view, and if you tried others, or did that just sort of come to you at the start and you knew that this is how you had to tell the story?
Both, in a way. It came to me in the start, but it wasn't the only start. In the early drafts of the book, all the persons are used. Some of the drafts, I'm in the first person, sometimes I'm in the second person, and sometimes I'm in the third person. And I was writing the story alternating between those different modes, and I wasn't sure until at least the halfway point, or maybe more, deeply into the project, maybe the two-thirds point, that it was going to be in the second person. In retrospect, that makes a certain sense because of my need for urgency for the story of love to come through. And so it makes sense to me now that I'm done, but I was far from sure that it was going to be in the second person. It simply presented itself more and more as the mode that best lent itself to me writing. I thought that one of the things that I'm doing in the book is telling the story of a hero, or more specifically a heroine. Generically speaking, the book is an epic in that regard, and that it's a story of an exceptional individual. And the exceptional individual, of course, doesn't perceive themselves as exceptional prodigies or unusual people. They don't walk around constantly shocked and amazed at the things that they're capable of. The things they're capable of seem as natural and normal as the things that we're capable of doing seem to us. And so I didn't think that I could render how remarkable she is directly through her voice without her sounding insufferable and self-absorbed. So I needed someone else to tell her story, and I could have, of course, had a distanced third party tell that story with a certain amount of amazement, but I had another story that I was telling alongside of the greatness of this individual or the remarkable capacities of this individual, and that was a story of love. And so writing in the second person, I was writing in the personage of a person whose function in the story is primarily to love and to communicate that love. And once I felt those imperatives really strongly, then I knew I was writing in the second person.
It's interesting. Well, you know, sort of along those lines, the main characters or the exceptional characters are either young or old, and I am curious what meaning readers should take from that.
That is something, it's really a really interesting process, publishing a book and touring around with it, because people ask you really brilliant, but also, in a way, self-evident questions or obvious questions that won't have been obvious to you or weren't obvious to me. And so, adults, of course, they don't come off so well and they don't figure so prominently in the book. The book is about the very young and the very old. One possibility is that this is, in a real sense, my first novel, and I think it's a very natural aesthetic instinct in one's first work to mine one's oldest experiences, one's first sense of the world, one's first experience. And so the part of the book that draws most directly and intensely upon my personal experience is the depiction of their childhood as the beginning of the book. And so there was a strong yearning that I had to write of those magical moments at the beginning of life, of first becoming aware of the world and what it was and how to live in it. But I also needed a really strong bond to do what I was going to do in the story, to have that much trust and that much camaraderie, that much complicity. And so I needed someone who was not only loyal to Hannah and not only in love with Hannah, but utterly trusted and known in a way that one only knows people who one has known one's entire life. It is also, in a way, an indictment of some of the hypocrisies and corruptions of all adult living as seen from a child's eyes and then from a young person's eyes. The revolution is basically a young person's game, and the revolutionary tendencies in the main characters and the revolutionary actions, for me, make most sense as acts of youth, the youthful outrage at the state of things, and youthful energy to try to change them. In the book, the idealistic youths, or the rebellious or revolutionary youths, they find natural allegiance with the very old, who also are a step away from the functioning of the society, especially the hyper old. There's a great grandparent who has the same remove from everyday activity as the protagonists, and who, in a certain sense, is their real educator or one of their real teachers. That, too, however, is something that I can feel and experience. My parents were hippies and had me quite young, and so I knew great-grandparents on both sides of my family, but my father's grandfather was a particularly mesmerizing and magnetic figure, and so some traces of him also are in the book. I realized after the fact that one of the things I wanted to do was to reflect upon that figure in my own life.
That's so interesting, because I was gonna ask you how your upbringing contributed to how you write, and or how you wrote Hannah versus the Tree. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It's a fascinating thing to think about as a writer, because you can't really see it. You can't really see in your own shadow in that way. There's some obvious things, just being read to by my parents and learning suspense, learning pleasure in language, in writing. All those things are very clear to me and very alive to me about my upbringing. I definitely think the basic political background setting of my youth, which was somewhere to the extreme left of the spectrum. My parents met in an anti-war rally, and when they had me when they were young, they were students and activists, and so their backdrop of the world in the book, just like the backdrop of my own world, was a really clear dissatisfaction with the political status quo, and a desire to change it in some way, or at least a healthy dose of skepticism that I was concerned its self-description or sort of basic everyday capitalist functioning. So that's definitely a factor for my upbringing, and a certain amount of freedom. I had quite a free youth, and ultimately the form that the book takes, I think, is quite free. It took me a long time to get free in the making of stories, but all those things I can feel resonating from my early youth.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the structure a little bit, because I as I was reading, I was curious how you came up with the structure, or if you thought about it greatly before you started writing and outlined anything, or really had a vision of what it would look like, or if you let the story unfold and the structure revealed itself to you as you were writing.
The latter. You say it really beautifully. I couldn't say it better, but that was exactly my experience. I'm a professor, and with my students, sometimes I think there are all sorts of writing temperaments, and some temperaments are very inclined toward outline and plan. And when I have students who are strongly inclined to outline and plan, I almost have a little difficulty teaching them, because I have such an opposite temperament. I really don't know what I want to say until I've written it and seen it in front of me. I can't conceive of a structure to fill in or fill out. I have to write and have it come out, reveal itself in the writing. And so as concerns the story, even the most fundamental events in the story, I was the last to know. I do remember quite clearly the moment when the story was done, when I was essentially done with the book. It came to me as a slight, it came to me as a surprise. It was a very intense feeling. It was a very definite feeling. Just to mention another one of your shows, again, when I was listening to you interview Amy Hempel, she talks with such amazing certainty about knowing when she's done, and she has such lucidity about that. And I had heard Amy talk about that experience before and had always been shocked and envious of it. And so I guess this is the first time I ever really finished something because I really did know it was done. But I didn't know its story ahead of time. The way I would work is, and the way I work still is, on any given day, I sit down and write freely for a time, maybe an hour or so, maybe more, maybe less. And then I return to the drafts that I've written on earlier days. And mostly I'm just deleting or crossing out things that I've written. But I'm retaining little bits here and there. And slowly those things are starting to coalesce. Those bits are starting to coalesce. And slowly I'm beginning to see in them a story or a structure. But I cannot relate to, I can't even imagine the experience of a novelist like, let's say, Balzac, but there are lots of novelists who are in this type who see the entire structure, who know the entire world that the book is taking place in, and they are filling it in as though they've sketched in a painting, and now they're with charcoal or pencil, and now they're painting it in. That seems like a fascinating experience, but it's definitely not mine. I could only discover the story in the writing of the individual sentences.
Hmm. Do you write first drafts longhand on the computer with a typewriter?
I write computer and longhand, depending on the occasion. I really like to write longhand. It is cumbersome, of course, because you have to retain what you wrote and keep it in and organize it and go back to it and develop it. And at some point, you need to transfer it to the main form, to the computer. I mostly write on the computer. With a really simple word processing program, not so complicated as Word or something like that. Mm-hmm. There's a program called IA Writer. It's a very bare bones word processing program that allows me to have lots of little files. But I alternate. Sometimes the changed pace of writing longhand helps me, and has always helped me. And so I alternate between the two.
So a few minutes ago, you talked about structure, how the structure came to you in the writing. And so I'm also curious about the character of Hannah. And the same, did you know this character that you wanted to write? How did she reveal herself to you?
Fascinating question. Excellent question. She does predate her story in my mind. I did know her before I knew what she would do. And I have no idea where she's from. She isn't based on any single person or even two or three or five. She's a pure invention in that regard. There are aspects of her character that I can relate to other things. In a certain sense, my book is a retelling of the story of Hannibal of Carthage. I don't think anyone would recognize it as that, not even a Roman historian. It's not at all obviously about such a person. But Hannibal had a unique military genius that all around him noted, which made him incredibly dangerous to enter into conflict with because of his sheer speed of intuition and insight. And so there are heroic figures, they're heroes who Hannah seems to me to resemble. But that particular shape of a character came to me in a way that I can't account for. I can see character traits from real and imagined individuals, but it is the real mystery to me of the book, why I imagined that person, why it was so appealing to me to set such a person in motion, to see what they would do, and to imagine someone feeling for such a person, to describe the love of such a person.
Yeah. Well, and your writing, it's so lyrical and poetic, and I'm curious about your relationship with poetry, whether you write it, you must read it.
I read it a lot. I teach it a lot. I never write it. I have no intention to mention Amy so much, but it's also the third and last time I'll mention Amy. I'm like Amy in that I have no sense for the line, or I don't have a natural sense for the line as a unit. I have a sense for the sentence. And so I think that for prose writers, that that is the great point of comparison. And poets lavish such care on their every sentence and employ so many unusual syntactical formations that I think that's really inspiring and really fascinating for the prose writer. And I think I get lots of intellectual nourishment, and I'm sure I get lots of ideas from reading poetry. I read more poetry than narrative prose. But I don't write it. I wrote it as an adolescent. I wrote some love poems in high school, and I have excited memories of that process. That was really pleasurable and really, really surprising. But you realize things about yourself over time as a writer, and I really don't have a natural sense for the weight of a line. I have no natural sense for enjambment. I really love making sentences, but I don't really know how to use the line. And so I take inspiration from it, but I don't write it.
Do you have poets that you return to time and again?
Definitely. Paul Celan is someone I return to a lot, and who I'm really in love with, really mesmerized by, really touched and heartbroken and moved by as a poet, shocked by, routinely shocked by. I just got done teaching a seminar this past semester on Wallace Stevens, which was a real joy. Wallace Stevens is definitely a lifelong love. I remember reading Wallace Stevens in high school and not quote unquote understanding it, but liking it so much, and then later reading a letter by Wallace Stevens where he described that as the ideal reading situation or the ideal reading response. And now I've over decades and in lots of different fora, I've read Stevens and am durably moved and durably fascinated and durably inspired by him. Lately, I've been reading Anne Carson's translations of Sappho and reflections on Sappho, and though there's of course very little of Sappho that remains, there's only one complete poem, and everything else is fragments, and even that poem might not be entirely complete. But I find Sappho a great inspiration, a great beauty, and I guess to round out the list, Emily Dickinson is a poet that I return to very often, and have recently had the experience of teaching, which is a great pleasure. And that's essentially an inexhaustible source of poetic pleasure, not only because she wrote so very many poems, but because they're so shockingly and diversely beautiful.
Well, you know, I'm curious also because of your sort of lyrical writing, and I listened to an interview, and I think it was with Between the Covers up in Portland with the host of that show, and I think you said something to the effect of you hear letters with colors.
Yes.
Talk about that.
So I have a mild form of so-called colored audition. I've studied some writers who have it as well. The phenomenon is simply that you associate or hear colors with sounds or letters. Almost all children have that form of synesthesia, of experiencing one sense or in another. And for most, it wears off. But mine has been quite strong and has remained. And so one of the reasons that I picked the name Hannah, and Ken Jones was kind enough to ask me how it was that I chose the name, and he'd wondered if it had anything to do with Hannibal. And indeed it does on some unconscious level. But one thing I liked about Hannah is that it's a palindrome. I liked its symmetry, that if you read it forwards or backwards, it's the same. But its colors are really beautiful, deep orange and red for me because of the colors of its letters and the colors of its sound. And so given that I was working day in and day out with this name, I really wanted it to be a color combination that I liked and that excited or pleased me. I can live with I can love and be happy about words that don't have colors that are particularly pleasing for me. My own first name is primarily a color of beige and with bits of yellow that I don't particularly like as a color formation. My last name has a lot of navy blue in it, which I quite like, and so it, it varies. It's not all pleasure, but I find Code Audition fascinating because it's so idiosyncratic. I remember once reading a Rimbaud poem called Voyelle Vowels, and his vowels are completely different than mine. Later, I stumbled across a passage in Nabokov, in Vladimir Nabokov's memoir, Speak Memory, where he talks about his own colored audition, his wife and his sons, and they have different colors for all the letters. It doesn't even seem to run in the family. It seems to be something deeply idiosyncratic for people, the colors associated with letters. But for me, that's definitely an added pleasure or an added complication in experiencing language, its colors.
Well, I was curious about, I'm looking at your book here, sitting here beside me, and, you know, down the side is the title, Hannah versus the Tree, and then at the bottom is your name, and so it goes from pink in, you know, a little orange into yellow, and I'm curious if you had any input in the color of that strip.
I didn't, and so it amazes me all the more. A really brilliant, I think, Son Thompson at McSweeney's made the covers, made a number of really beautiful McSweeney's covers. So he did the cover, and I didn't tell him that I had that association with the name. I didn't tell him anything about my private color theory. And so seeing it on the cover was a shock and a delight. To be punctilious, it isn't actually the color of her name. Her name definitely doesn't have any pink in it. It's not such an electric color. So it's not, so to speak, spot on, but it's in the chromatic family of my vision. And so that's already very striking. And the other thing about the cover that really struck me is the wolf on it. Because that isn't something that when I met with McSweeney's in San Francisco, we had talked about. We talked about trees or maybe about a family tree or one of the ideas was even a tattoo on a young woman's in the nape of her neck of a tree. There were different ideas that we were talking about, but not about a wolf and not with this layout. And Sun Ra did a variety of test covers, and this one stood apart. He didn't do very many versions of this, but the way that the wolf looks at the reader is exactly how I want it to, how I want the prose and the feel of the book to. And so my feeling about the object couldn't be more serene and happy and satisfied and understood. And I'm mystified by by that art. I think there's real art to book design, and I think Sun Ra's a real artist, and so I think he made a really beautiful book and one that really pleases its author, one that really pleases me. I've been happy to be seeing it as I move about the world with it.
Yeah,
really proud of it.
It's quite lovely, and I love the size, how you can just hold it in your hand. You know, you can hold it in your hand. It's not too heavy. It's not, you know, you can read it lying down. It's not going to crush you. I just love it. Love everything about it.
Me too.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about teaching and, you know, how that affects your writing and how you teach writing.
Right. So hitherto, I have only ever taught critical writing, essayistic writing. I've never taught creative writing. And I don't know that I ever will, but I also don't know that we need to draw such a sharp line between those two realms. So I don't know how to work with students who are developing a story. And because I don't think very easily in outline format, I imagine I would just be terrible at it, and I'll probably never do it. Teaching writing for me, this is a complete cliche, but it's such a true cliche, it bears repeating, that it seems to me that, as Verlin Klinkenborg once said, the only way that you become a better writer is by becoming a better reader. And so when I see that the two activities in my teaching as led by reading different kinds of things, reading poetry, reading prose, reading nonfiction, reading fiction, reading things from prior centuries, reading contemporary things are all ways of enlarging one's capacity as a writer and becoming a better writer. But I think there's also a lot of natural neurosis that comes with the writing process, especially when it's done in an institutional setting. Students are trying to please their professors, writing the way that they think the professors want them to write, taking on or imitating an authoritative tone like the authorities they recognize in their worlds. And so for me, one part of being a writer is learning what interests you, what your own voice is, how you, and also learning how to be comfortable with that, how to explore one's own unique capacities as a writer. So a lot of that happens simply in writing and rereading what one's written and revising it and looking for ways of expanding or contracting it. And some of that is having a certain attitude toward reading. Once one becomes really engaged in writing, I think one begins to read in a different way and to notice what holds one. So, for example, I wasn't reading Thomas Bernhard when I was writing Hannah, but Thomas Bernhard has a really amazing capacity for mesmerizing his reader. He often writes in second person, and there's this voice, a kind of ancient mariner voice, which is buttonholing you and holding you. You don't know why, and you don't know where the strange urgency of the narrator is coming from, but you're fascinated by the voice itself. And so that exploring the different teaching writing is exploring two sets of possibilities: how to read and how to learn from one's reading, how to learn what works on one, and then to imitate or repeat it. And then a lot of writing, of course, is just experience. It blows my mind that there are writers like Keats or like Rimbaud who are fully fledged poets, in Rimbaud's case as a teenager, and in Keats's case as in his early 20s. But the natural process, I think, is a much longer one, where you write and write and write and get better and better at it in a very slow, incremental way. And so I also, in teaching students to write, I try to encourage the attitude of constant growth and constant being constantly on the lookout for things that will make you a better writer in your reading.
Yeah. Well, in closing, we have a couple of minutes left. I wonder if we could go back to something that kind of feeds into this, which is earlier you talked about writing temperaments. And how might someone discover what their writing temperament is?
That's a brilliant question. That's a beautiful question. And I really don't know. I'm happy to have found mine. Even writing critical studies of authors that are dear to me, like Beckett, I recognized my own temperament that I discover through writing, that I don't really know what I have to say until I've said it. I do think that's a basic fact that people know about themselves, and so I do think that we all know our basic writing temperament, how we like to write. And of course, there are writers who do a lot of thinking and a lot of mental composition before they ever put pen to paper or keys or fingers to keys. But I think experimentation is the only way. When I teach, I try to get students different kinds of assignments where they're, say, imitating the style of a certain writer, so they're reading a lot of Joyce to try to imitate Joyce's style, or they're reading a lot of Virginia Woolf to try to imitate it, to recognize aspects of it. But I really think only by experimentation can one really more deeply find and feel one's own temperament, and therefore find a mode of writing that is in harmony with that. But I wish I knew a path through the forest, but wandering is the only one I know.
Yes. Well, I have so enjoyed talking with you. I'm so glad you were here for the hour. And thank you so much, Leland, for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You were listening to Writers on Writing. I was with Leland de la Durante. His book is Hannah Versus the Tree, and it's published by McSweeney's. It's a lovely novel. It's a beautiful novel, and I hope you check it out. Again, thanks to all of you for donating to our fundraiser. We really appreciate it, and you're helping KUCI stay on the air, and we love that. That's all for now. I hope you will come back next week. And in the meantime, writers out there, remember, to stay in the chair.
Well, your rocks may be a broken heart. Oh, yeah, you come from a broken home. There may be a monkey on your back or in a crowded room, and you still feel alone. To 10 and looks, you're a 3 still. You were born to be like the greatest of men. Everything you need, you already got. So wear your buttons with the sun on your chin, cause everybody's got their very own bag. You were born to be like the greatest of men.
Of their birth, and it's